Welcome to Restore, a podcast seeking to restore the vision, restore the mission, restore the church. And now your host, Javier Diaz.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Restore Podcast, episode 54. My name is Javier, and I'm your host. This episode is part three of our series on tithing. The first one, as some of you may recall, was episode 45 with Dr. Judd Lake. And in that episode, we were discussing a brief history and theology of tithing in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And part two was episode 51 with Florida Conference CFO Treasurer Elisa Ramming, which we conversed about how tithe is distributed at the local conference level. And in this third part of the series, we talk with former Southern Union and current North American Division CFO Treasurer Pastor Randy Robinson. He will give a lot of good information regarding how tithe is distributed at the different levels of our church structure regarding the union to the general conference. Many already have found these informational episodes, or at least that's what I like to call them, about how our tithing system actually works, actually how it's distributed. They found it helpful and praise the Lord, also hopeful. And though we don't claim to cover every aspect and perspective and view in this series, my desire continues to be that it may be one source among many that are out there that can be used to help better inform the listener on how tithing is used in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I want to thank Randy for his time and his passion, his love, first and foremost for Jesus and for the work that he's been called to do. And thank you for taking of your time to record this episode. And also Elisa Ramming, for she joins me once again, but this time as my co-host. I know that you will not only be informed by this conversation, but you will be blessed. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Pastor Randy Robinson. Well, I want to welcome Pastor Randy Robinson to the Restore Podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Javier. Good to be here. My privilege.
It's great to have you, Randy. And also, of course, great to have my co-host for this episode, Elisa. Elisa, welcome back to the Restore Podcast, now as a co-host. Thank you for helping me.
Thank you. It's good to be here and joining along with this conversation.
So, Randy, we're going to start where I almost always start. And I know that many of our listeners have probably heard another podcast or, vlog, whatever it may have been. But nonetheless, I want to start here with just you telling us a little bit about your, faith, journey. Obviously, here in the Southern Union, we've gotten to know you a little bit better. I've sat in, meetings with you, and every time you stand up, you everybody knows that you are standing up because you're 6 foot six. And so just a little humor here. So, Randy, tell us a little bit about, where you're from and how you got to, be where you're at now.
Sure. Thank you. I was born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area, big city. Mm. I am the product of four generations of Seventh-day Adventist membership. Actually, four on my father's side, three on my mother's side. So I have a long history. I'm a Seventh-day Adventist through and through. Mm. And so that's never been in question for me. Attended Adventist schooling my whole career, all the way through college, and never really intended to work for the church. I it was never in question about my Seventh-day Adventist belief. I was, that's solid. But I never really intended to work for the church. That was just a circumstantial situation that, frankly, I resisted for quite some number of years, even after I was employed by the church. I didn't really think that was my calling. And kind of to make a long story short, I finally realized that about 10 years in, it took me about 10 years to figure out that God really was wanting me, and my calling was to work for the Seventh-day Adventist Church for my career, which I've done now for about going on 38 years here now. Mm. In college, met my beautiful wife of 37 years. We have two grown sons and two now great daughters-in-law. No grandkids yet, sadly, but we'll just wait to decide when that happens. But in terms of my faith journey, like I said, I've been a Seventh-day Adventist from birth. That's a very solid belief in my heart. My relationship with Jesus really solidified as an adult in my mid-30s. Mm. It was kind of, yeah, my parents did that, and I always went to church, and that was just comfortable. But in terms of a relationship with Jesus, that really solidified in my mid-30s as I was even then working for the church, just discovered that, you know, daily life was not going to be complete for me without the assistance and relationship with Christ. It was incomplete until that time for me. And it's grown. I this is a growing experience. As I have my morning devotions with myself and then with my wife in the evening, we have our family worship together. It's a growing experience. I'm learning something new every day. Amen. Trying to walk closer with Jesus every day. And that's an important part of my life. It's a necessary part of my life. And it really goes hand in hand now, not only with my personal life, but with my professional life. What I do on a daily basis and the influence I may have in the church setting sits on the foundation of my relationship with Jesus. And it has to. That's integral to who I am and how I do my job. Mm.
Thank you, Randy, for that. And we praise God for how he has, led you. Elisa, I remember in your story when I interviewed you, Elisa had a job outside of our church, of our denomination, and making more money as she was, especially in the field of finance and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. So, and people can go back and listen to that. But what was that like for you, Randy? Because you also, I envision, had many offers as you finished school and that you could have gone. So I always like to hear the story of why you specifically chose to then go and do church work, right? Where not that we do it for the money, but obviously that's a factor. I mean, if we're honest with ourselves, that's a factor. But nonetheless, I know it's a calling as well. You know, we often talk about the calling of the pastor and teachers, but the calling of, working in different fields within our denomination. So maybe tell us a bit about that as well. Why you chose to stay here in the church field as opposed to a secular, job.
Yeah. I as I mentioned, it took me about 10 years to figure out that working for the church was what God wanted me to do. Mm-hmm. And during that 10-year time, I was actively attempting, I'll explain that in a minute, actively attempting to exit church work. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of very notable situations where I believe, looking back on it in hindsight, God really directed the process circumstantially to keep me in the church.
Yeah.
Here, if I can be very transparent in this moment, my thinking at that moment was, I'm going to leave church work and get a real job.
Mm.
I wasn't so much driven by dollars at that moment in my 20s and early 30s. The church does not pay badly
right
early on in your tenure in the church. It's pretty competitive, at least it was back then. So it wasn't money that was driving me. It was really, I want to get out and get away from this kind of cushy, I don't know why, it was an odd thinking, to get a real job. That was really the thought I had. I was interviewing, I was sending my resume out. I had recommendations at that time. I had a friendship with with a mayor of a city where I was. He was a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, and we taught the Sabbath school lesson together. But he was actively looking for places for me to work in his city. A recommendation in one particular instance, and my wife actually worked for healthcare, has done that for many years, but there were openings where she was, and I applied, and you know, and her influence helped. But circumstantially, in those instances, there were very specific interventions that I look back now and conclude that it was divine intervention that prevented me from taking some jobs I actually had opportunities to take.
Yeah.
And in one instance, it was literally, I made this decision. I remember the decision very distinctly. I actually had an offer to go out. And I, you know, I was, you know, like I said, I was actively trying to get out of church employment. And the offer that I had on the table was roughly financially equivalent to where I was then. And I just decided, it's not worth making a lateral financial move. That I remember making that conscious decision not to go out, because it was, you know, why do that? You know, let 10,000 more to uproot my life.
Yeah.
And change employment. But no, there were some interventions in there that really I look back on and think that was divinely guided. And then right about 10 years in, I received an invitation to be a treasurer for the first time in my career. I was I was working in treasury, but I was invited to be a conference treasurer at the age of 33, I think I was. And it was just a few weeks into that job that I said, you know, I had better figure out how I can connect with God, because I can't do this job without him.
Amen.
So that was kind of the turning point
in
my career.
Well, it's, you know, as I've listened as a pastor to so many stories of people that have worked in the church and then and or in the secular field, if I can say it that way, I think one after another, it's the way that, as you mentioned, providence has led people, and God absolutely, you know, calls people to work in certain places for his, you know, glory, and calls people to work within the church and uses them for his glory as well. So we're thankful for your story and for how God has led you, and what he's doing in your life. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear just how God kept you and kept you for his work, for his church and for his work. So that's amazing. We're definitely thankful for that. So tell us, what does a day in the life of the North American Division treasurer look like?
I love that question coming from our treasurer here at Florida Conference. Yeah. That's awesome.
Well, let me tell you, Elisa, it's different than yours, because I've sat in your seat in a conference. You know, I anticipated it to be different than what my previous experience was in unions and conferences, but the level of difference is pretty significant. You know, I sit in meetings constantly. That's my job today. Now, that sounds mundane, and it sounds like, why? You know, why do people sit in meetings? Why would an officer of the North American Division sit in meetings all day long? Why would that's like a waste? Well, you know, some of it may be, but really the function is, the functional change is how we deliver the way the church works. How do we structure the way the church works? And that's a constant evaluation at the North American Division level. That's what I do most of the time. How do we look at the landscape of how the church works? Operationally, policy, polity, financially, how do we look at that landscape and say, how can we make it better? And that really is the function that I really take on most of the time. Now, the pandemic era, it's really changed dramatically. And honestly, I'm ready for it to be over, because I didn't realize that the travel piece of what I did before the pandemic was a moment to kind of take a breath from meetings and just getting away from that and being able to reprocess what's going on. I don't have that moment now, because like today, I started in meetings at 9 a.m. So happened today. On Monday, I will start at 6 a.m. Go till 7 p.m. straight in these meetings. So, but to put some meat on the bone, it really is, how do we evaluate the policies of the church? How does the church better function? How can the North American division assist its constituents better to deliver the gospel? I mean, it's really simple. It really does take thought in terms of the structure of our church to deliver the gospel message. Mm. We have a lot of different entities. I deal with departments on how they structure their programs and how they fund their programs. I'm just coming off budget meetings right now. We'll talk about the dollars in a moment, I expect. Mm-hmm. But we're coming off, I just spent a couple of weeks in budget meetings with every department of the North American division. How do we fund their department and the delivery of their product to help fund the ministry of the church in their particular areas? And there's such a wide range of areas. How do we build resources? How do we provide resources? How do we ascertain from the local field? Elisa, how do I connect with the Southern Union and the other eight unions of the North American division, and say to them, what can we do for you that will help you and give you the tools you need to provide a mechanism for you to deliver the gospel? What kind of resources can we give you, and where do we direct those resources so that you have the best possibility of delivering the gospel message? The church is a big organization. It's sometimes cumbersome. And it moves somewhat slowly at times, but because of the complexity of the organization and the many tentacles that it has throughout the world, literally, it takes some infrastructure and some planning and some thought to make sure that it works as efficiently as it can. And it doesn't always work efficiently, and I'll be the first to admit that. But it does take that effort on the part of senior leadership, which is a seat I happen to sit in, to just make sure that at least in my lane, my financial lane, that I'm delivering as efficiently as I can the resources that God puts in front of us to manage.
Yeah, and that does make sense, because we're not some small organization. We're a huge organization. So it takes a lot to keep things going and to make sure that the ultimate goal, as you say, the deliverance of the gospel, is being accomplished in the best way. So thank you for sharing. Yeah.
You know, Randy, you mentioned already a few areas where the pandemic has, shifted things for you, as it has for all of us, and continues to do so. With that said, what are some other ways that you feel the pandemic has affected the North American division, therefore, the rest of the church at different levels? Obviously, financial, that's why you're here. I'm sure you're going to say, much about that. But Specifically, like when you mentioned travel, right? That's a big one. I know you've had questions like that before. I mean, we get it at the local level. I don't travel as much as you do, but I did a lot of traveling within Florida, right? I'm driving here, driving there, staying overnight, eating here, just because I have a wide area that I cover. But along with going to meetings and ministerial with NAD and things of that nature, and that's all great, but we've all realized, right, just to be, as you said earlier, transparent and honest, that a lot of that now is being reevaluated of how much we really need to do that more than ever before. Mm-hmm. And just to further that, when I spoke to Elder Dan, you know, Jackson before he retired, or right about when he was about to retire, he mentioned that as well, that people are just what we were doing pre-COVID, we were already having these conversations, but everything got fast forwarded, right? And these were my words. He said it a bit, you know, differently. So with all that said, yeah, what are some of the effects that it's had, and not just now during the pandemic, I mean, we're still in it, but things that you think will continue to, you know, go forward in a different way. So yeah.
Absolutely. I firmly believe that God has used this pandemic to help us rethink how we do church. I firmly believe that. I don't believe God is a God that delivers evil. He doesn't, clearly. There's a deceiver, as the Bible tells us, that
sure.
delivers evil. But God is a big enough God to be able to use circumstances for his good. I mean, all things work together for good for those that love God and are called according to his purposes, the Bible says. And I believe this is one of those moments. And so the church has been able to rethink how it does business. And one of the biggest things is we didn't believe that we could not travel. We could refrain from travel and still do business in the church. We didn't think that. We had to fly across the country to a meeting to be there in person, to do what we had to do, and then fly back and spend the money to do that. Well, now we figured out the pandemic has taught us that that's not necessarily true. I'm not saying that we should never do things in person. That would be a mistake, I believe.
Right.
Because there's the ability to gather together and to meet together is important, but we can significantly curtail that because we've been taught we had no choice, so we had to adapt, and the adaptation has taken place at every level of the organized church, from the general conference right down to the local church. Local churches are now deciding, you know, how do we do ministry in our community in a remote way? We can't come to church. We can't meet at the church. So how do we meet the needs of our community where our church sits? How do we do that? And our churches are figuring out how to do that. It really is amazing. Mm-hmm. My local church where I go and attend and, well, frankly, listen now, online to sermons is figuring out ways to meet the needs of the community in ways they would never have conceived of without a pandemic. And there are many churches like that. Our media ministry, for instance, another great example that just happened was It Is Written had planned a major evangelistic event at Indianapolis, where our general conference session was going to be held this past July, and the pandemic interrupted that. And you know, they would have had a hall, and they would have maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people show up and had an evangelistic series. But the pandemic interrupted that, so they pivoted and did it online. And they had, I think, they had 25,000 registrants. They had many, many, many more thousands of people reached in the pandemic setting than they did in the in-person setting. So the church is just learning how to adapt to this new reality. Mm-hmm. And in very practical terms, I referenced my budget meetings earlier. We are collectively agreeing, and I'm saying I'm the treasurer, and yes, we're cutting back our travel budgets, but our departmental directors, as I'm meeting with them, are coming in and saying, we embrace the fact that we are not going to budget nearly as much as travel. I mean, it's a significant reduction. Going to go forward. That will continue forward because we've figured out we can do business in a virtual environment, and we don't have to go all over the country and spend air tickets and hotel rooms and all the other expenses that go along with that travel. We've figured out that we can do it in a virtual environment and do it effectively. Is it comfortable? No. I mean, I'm tired of Zoom.
Sure.
Without Zoom, I gotta say.
It's the balance, right? I think also it's also healthier for our families. That you get to stay home a bit more with your family there, and still get the work of the church done. I heard from a pastor recently. He said, I don't think we're going to go back to our church board meetings in person anytime soon. He said, I'm getting more attendance via Zoom or whatever software they want to use, because people that are working or doing whatever they're doing, they get to be home, and they're literally eating, having a pizza, taking care of what they need to do, and at the same time, they're in the meeting. I mean, these little things at the local level, I say little things, are huge aspects for a church. So the average church that was having issues, getting their board members to go to a meeting per se for good reasons, they got to get home, they got to feed their families. Well, now you can have a Bluetooth headset, walk around the house, and at least be listening and talking. That was never heard of before, even though the technology was there, if we're honest, pre-COVID. And so now people are saying, pastor, I mean, and these were people that pre-COVID, I would venture to say, according to the pastor, would have never have agreed to do a meeting like that for a church board, are saying, we're good. Let's just continue to do it this way. And in that local level, they're actually saving money too. That laypersons are not driving to and from the local building and things like that. So it's really fascinating to see from the local level all the way up, right? The organization, the way that the pandemic has shifted, affected, and will continue to do so. So thank you for that.
Yeah, continue to do so is correct. So let's get into some of the financial details.
All right.
So the NAD receives tithe from the union, which has received it from the local conferences, which has received it from the local churches. So we have that whole trail. Tell us three things. How tithe is distributed at the union level, and then how tithe is distributed at the North American division level. And then maybe tell us a little bit about how it's distributed at the general conference level. And lately we've been hearing a lot about tithe parity as it relates to North American division and other divisions distributing up to the general conference. So tell us a little bit about that as well.
Sure. Let me start with the basic number. 20,000 in 2019, which is the last year end we have available to us. We haven't finished 2020 yet, so I don't know what that'll be. But in 2019, the church in North America collected $1,075,000,000 in tithe. That's the baseline. So what happens to that $1,075,000,000 of tithe when it's collected primarily at the local church? That's collected in some other areas, but primarily at the local church, that's where it happens. Okay, all of that money, all of the tithe dollars collected at the local church flow to the local conference. Every penny of that, nothing is retained in terms of tithe dollars at the local church. That money flows to the local conference. Okay. From there, our church policies sort of take over and direct the tithe in several different directions. The local conference keeps the majority of those dollars. Now, that varies a little bit from conference to conference, Elisa, as you know. The larger conferences, which Florida is one, probably keeps a little, ultimately keeps a little less dollars than some of the smaller conferences. And that's because of a principle called the strong helping the weak. That's the principle the Seventh-day Adventist Church financial system sits on. Let me talk about how the dollars flow. So the conference collects 100% of the tithe, and then the conference from there sends essentially three percentages away to different parts of the organization. It's many more than that, but they're primarily three. One, it sends 9% of that tithe to the union, to its local union. There are nine local unions in the North American division. Florida Conference is a part of the Southern Union. Mm-hmm. And so Florida Conference, in your case, Elisa, 9% of those tithe dollars to the union, to its union. Then in addition to that, the second piece that is sent away is it will send 15% to the General Conference / North American Division. Now, the reason I say General Conference / North American Division is because there's a bit of a misunderstanding about the structure of the church. The division really does not stand alone by itself and in counter distinction to the General Conference. The North American division and all other world divisions, there are 13 total, of which North America is one, and North America is the largest financially. It is not the largest in terms of membership, but the largest financially, is one of those 13. And it is the General Conference in the North American division territory. So when you get to the division level, you've arrived at the General Conference. We isolate or we name areas, geographic areas of the General Conference in 13 different names. Mm-hmm. North America is one of those names. So we are the General Conference in the North American division territory. But that entity, GC/ North America, receives 15% of the tithe dollar from the local conference. Okay, so Elisa sends 9% to the union, 15% to the North American division / General Conference.
So if I can jump in here just for a second. So for example, in 2019, Elisa, you could correct me, the Florida Conference received approximately some $60 million in tithe, correct?
Correct, approximately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Elisa spoke a little bit about this in her episode. So tell us from that perspective, you're saying that 9% of that goes to the Southern Union, in our case, obviously, and then 15% of that goes to the GC/NAD.
That's correct. Then once we, and let me just kind of take a little curve here, when the North American division receives that 15%, it in 2019 sent just under 6% to the General Conference office. Okay. So there is a split between the North American division and the General Conference in the terms of tithe. We'll talk about that in the tithe parity conversation in a moment that Elisa referenced earlier. But then there's a third thing that Elisa does with money, and it's this depends on your organization a little bit, so it varies a little bit. But essentially, Elisa then sends approximately 11% of those tithe dollars to the legacy retirement plan of the North American division, Seventh-day Adventist Church. So those are the three main areas that take most of the dollars once they arrive at at the local conference. Okay. And those dollars are obviously the retirement piece is spent on providing retirement benefits and healthcare benefits to retirees of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in North America.
Right. Now, let me ask you about just what I like about these episodes, like the one with Elisa, is that we really try to break it down here for people to kind of know. And so we'll get a little bit into the weeds, maybe not too much. But so that 9%, let's start with the union. So I can really ask you this question as the former treasurer of the union and specifically our union here. So where did that, let's begin there with the union. Where did that 9% go to? Staff, departmental budgets, how did that amount of funds really affect the rest of the union? So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I'll speak to the Southern Union in particular. The Southern Union is made up of 8 conferences. Okay. It is the largest union in the North American division, both in finances and membership. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and unions vary in size dramatically. Yeah, we have there are unions, for instance, that have an annual tithe similar to the Florida Conference.
Right.
In total. So they vary dramatically in size. But the dollars in a very simple explanation, basically the Southern Union operated on approximately 4% of that 9%. Okay. And when I say operated, I mean the people and services and functionality that exist in the building of the Southern Union Conference, in the actual office building, took up approximately 4% of that 9% to operate. That's departments, that's administration, that's services that needed to be done in the building. Everything that happened in that building was approximately 4%. Okay, the other 5%, roughly, was used in terms of direct appropriations or assistance to other entities of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Most of that 5% would go back to our local conferences in various forms. The two largest forms those monies flowed back to our local conferences were really in education dollars, funding for education, and funding for evangelism. Those are the two main areas that 5% flowed back. Now, I'm going to reference back to something I said earlier in terms of the stronger helping the weaker.
Yeah.
Or the larger, smaller is another way to say. Yeah. some of those dollars that flow back are kind of restructured, and Florida Conference, because of its size, would get less of those dollars because it's more capable of doing some of the things that those dollars would affect. Than some of our smaller conferences in the Southern Union. For instance, the Gulf States Conference, the Kentucky-Tennessee Conference, are smaller conferences in the Southern Union that received more of those dollars from that remaining 5% than Florida Conference did, because they needed more assistance in those areas. So that's where some of the readjustment, restructure of financial flow helps those smaller entities in primarily those two areas. I mean, there are far more subsidies that happen and dollars that flow in smaller amounts. But the primary two areas are education and evangelism, where dollars flowed back to our local conferences.
And I think it's a good opportunity now to just kind of tap in a little bit regarding the Special Assistance Fund, which was
Perfect.
Previously known as the Small Conference Fund, where it's the same premise, the stronger, the larger are helping the weaker or the smaller. So tell us a little bit about that.
Perfect. Yes, Elisa. I mentioned that there are three main areas where conferences sent money out once they receive the tithe. A fourth is this is what you reference, Elisa, is the Conference Assistance Fund. And that that is designed, very specifically designed to help our smaller, more needy conferences. That's absolutely what it was designed for. Approximately, it's not quite, it's a little bit under 1% of the gross tithe dollar. Okay, that's what's collected. Excuse me. Just slightly under 1%. The fund is built out of those dollars to assist our smaller conferences by mathematical formula. Just provide additional operating dollars. And the formula is designed really on the premise of assisting conferences that have a lower per capita tithe giving within their conference. And some of our conferences operate, as you might expect, in more challenging financial circumstances than other conferences. Some of our regional conferences, a lot of people mischaracterize these dollars as funds flowing to regional conferences directly. And that is a mischaracterization. Do regional conferences receive these funds? Yes, they do. A large number of them do. But it's not because they're regional conferences. It's because some of them operate within a circumstantial setting of more difficult financial circumstances on several levels. I mean, they are serving a population often that are socioeconomically disadvantaged. They're in the urban areas. They're immigrants. They're other people groups that are challenged financially. And that is part of the church that serves those less capable, less able population groups. And that's costly. And so the church has a bit of a mechanism to assist conferences that do that. And it's not exclusively regional conferences. There are other areas, like Canada is another area that is very much in that category. They serve a geographic area that has vast areas of nothing. And they have little areas of population that they have to get to and serve. And it's costly to do that. But we do as a church. We decide we are going to serve these small of populations that are isolated in places. We want the gospel to go there just as much as it goes to a big city. And so we find a mechanism that allows those conferences to do that. And the Small Conference Assistance Fund helps them do that, deliver that ministry in those ways to either socioeconomically challenged areas or isolated areas, or other situations that are just costly to deliver the gospel. We have this mechanism that assists them to do that.
Yeah, that's very nice, very nice. Javier, if you want to go, I do want to hone in a little bit on the amount that the NAD and GC office, mm-hmm. that 15% that conferences send up. If you can tell us a little bit about how that is distributed throughout the NAD/GC office, that would be great.
Absolutely. The church structure is, I'll say, loosely designed to deal with, to identify areas that certain parts of the organization can do better than other parts of the organization. For instance, a conference has the ability to manage maybe a K-8 school system. A local church can't do that. and so, but a conference can. Unions can manage bigger. They can run a university. They can manage a university, and provide resources that maybe a conference can't quite manage on its own. Obviously, Florida Conference can do certain things that maybe a Gulf States Conference can't, because they're just bigger. But a union serves to do some things and to manage some things that a local conference can't. And the same goes with a division in the general conference. The division serves to manage systems that maybe a local union could not do, either geographically or just plain size. For instance, the division manages and operates a media system. We have 6 or 7 different media outlets that deliver the gospel in different ways and different methodologies, but the division manages that. The division manages a publishing house. The division supports a seminary. That's largely the GC does that too, but that's in our territory of the North American division. So there are things that we can do that our more local entities can't. And so to answer your question very specifically, Elisa, where do those dollars go? 15%. Let me tell you very specifically how that is divvied up. Once the division, I'll say it this way, it doesn't exactly work this way mechanically, but once the division receives that 15%, it sends right now, today, 5.85%, just under 6% of those dollars to the general conference. Okay, so we retain a little under 10% to operate our office. We take approximately... it's between 3 and 4% of that. That cares for the office operation where we are geographically in Columbia, Maryland. We come to an office building. There's 150 people that show up there. To cover them and what they do takes about between 3 and 4% of the remaining 9-ish% of what we retain. The rest of it literally goes out in subsidies to different parts of the church. Again, largely it encompasses evangelism and education. Those are the main pieces. But at the division level, there's some additional pieces that aren't covered by more local areas, such as auditing, we mentioned special assistance, evangelism, education. We run and we own and operate a university, Oakwood University. Dollars flow there. So those are subsidies. And then there are subsidies that go more locally to unions and even the local field sometimes. But the operation of the church in North America takes about between 3 and 4% of gross tithe of that $1,075,000,000 that I mentioned.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah,
about 3.5% of that is used to run the North American division office. The rest of the dollars go out to various areas that I mentioned earlier. And the same thing happens at the general conference level, except on a worldwide scale. They receive, from North America, they receive 5.85% of tithe dollars. From the rest of the world divisions, they receive 2% of tithe this year. Now, somebody's going to say, why in the world is North America paying nearly 6% and the rest of the world divisions only pay 2%? Why? Well, that's a good question. But it really goes back to the fact that the Seventh-day Adventist Church worldwide started in North America. And I believe that was God designed. We have the resources. We had the resources more than any other worldwide area. And so the North American Division, funded the World Seventh-day Adventist Church at its infancy. And some of those policies were put in place to make sure that the world had resources to deliver the gospel. And so North America paid a lot of dollars into world expansion of the church. Mm. But now that some of those world divisions, the other 12 divisions beside North America, are growing and maturing, they're able to financially lift a little more. So discussions, Elisa, that you mentioned earlier about tithe parity have begun, and saying, okay, let's shift a little more of the financial burden to those world divisions that are now maturing financially and more able to manage and lift some of these financial burdens that the North American division has carried. And let's shift that a little bit. So starting in 2021, there's actually going to be a shift in those dollars. I mentioned that, Elisa, you are sending now 15% to the General Conference of North American Division. That's going to go down in 2021 to 14.5%. Mm. And in 2022, it's going to be 14. In 2023, it's going to be another 0.5%, and so on. So when we're in 2024, that 5.85% is going to be reduced by 2%.
Wow.
By the same token.
Which we're talking millions of dollars, or just
millions of dollars. Oh, yeah. Many, many millions
of
dollars.
Many, many millions.
Yes, yes. By the same token, over a 10-year period, starting in 2021, the world divisions are going to go up from 2% to 3%. Okay? So they're coming up. Our division is going down, and that's what we call tithe parity. Mm-hmm. Get those two numbers a little closer together so that we're operating more on an equal basis. And so, and there's some discussions about other items beside tithe. We are talking about tithe very specifically, but there are other areas that the North American division has carried happily, I might add, for the benefit of the world church. And some of those things are being discussed. For instance, the funding of our auditing service. North America largely carries that cost for the benefit of the world church. And we're talking about how that shifts a little bit financially and shifting a little bit of that burden to the maturing areas of the world church. We don't want to hurt the world church mission. We don't want to, hurt anybody financially, but we are in discussion about how that gets evened out a little bit more because the world church is maturing in its ability to lift financially.
Wow, that's a lot of information there.
I knew it. It gets into the weeds.
Good that's information.
Good. Exactly. I was going to say that. Good information. A lot of information, but good information. And that's why, hey, people can pause and listen to it again. But I think, part of the reason that we have put out these episodes and is really, as I call them, informational episodes. Let it be transparent, and then let people listen and decide and learn for themselves. And I think a lot of people perhaps have never heard of for example, the small conference, fund. And I don't know, I think you said it's a different name for it now. A lot of people, church members they understand that tithe pays their quote pastor. And if they have a school, part of it helps to pay their teacher. But as the more you speak, the more we get to see how that tithe dollar, which Elisa, you and I spoke about in your episode as well, it just goes and further expands to do amazing work in different places. Mm-hmm. And I like what you inferred earlier, Randy, that by no means is our system, quote, perfect. I mean, I don't know that there is a perfect, system. Mm-hmm. And we're continuously needing to, I've said this many times on different episodes, but in real life, I call it AAA, assess, adjust, adapt, right? We need to continuously be doing that. And it does take longer. I think that's the frustrating part sometimes for many. I will admit, for myself as well at times, is that it takes a long time, right? I mean, the tithe parity, right? It took a year just to get there because it happens at these big constituency, meetings. And then when you vote, it's going to take another year. And sometimes it may take longer. for different reasons. And that could be good, doing things slow, but it also, in fairness, can be a little frustrating at the same time. And you guys obviously can't see this, but they're both shaking their heads yes as I'm saying this. Because I believe that even you get frustrated, Randy, when you want something done faster, right? Is that fair to say?
Very fair. Very fair.
Yeah. So, but it's, to me, again, it's fascinating. I'm going on a personal aspect here. With that said, understanding that we need to continuously assess, adjust, adapt. It is fascinating for me as a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, aside from my role here at the conference and anything else, to see, I don't think there's any other organization that a tithe dollar goes so far to do so many things.
I love that, Javier. I'm so glad you brought that up. As a tithe-paying Seventh-day Adventist Church member, I am thrilled that when I return $1 of tithe, my tithe dollar touches every aspect of the Seventh-day Adventist Church work around the world. A piece of my $1 pays my pastor in my local church. Mm-hmm. A piece of my $1 supports the conference work where my church is located. A piece of my dollar helps the union territory and my division territory. And it also helps pastors in India and Africa and Australia and Europe. I love that concept that when that $1 of my tithe returned helps all of that. It's an amazing reality to me. And I love that concept.
Mm. Fascinating. Any other thing or that you want to let us know about that tithe distribution from the local church to the local conference, to the union that we talked about? Again, just for a quick, recap, the union gets 9% from the conference, and then 15% goes to the GC/NAD. And thank you for, again, that clarifying, Mark, that actually the NAD is part of the GC, and in case people didn't know that. And then how that is distributed within the NAD. I think you said, correct me here if I'm wrong, I put some notes here, but I may have, missed something. Approximately 3-4% of that is to cover staffing, right, and the NAD, and the rest goes to, different parts of, fulfilling the ministry and going back into conferences and unions and evangelism, help for education. Mm-hmm. And the same happens at the GC level, where a small percentage goes to take care of the staff and pay Elder Wilson and everybody else. And then the other percentage goes to, again, ministry at local levels, but in the GC level, you're talking about the world church at different parts of the world. So did I miss anything? Anything else? And the small conference fund, again, to help those. And again, I think I mentioned this in the episode with Elisa, but Florida Conference for years now has been the largest conference in receiving tithe funds, and it's the second largest in membership to the Southeast California Conference, just for those, numbers. But here in the Southern Union, many conferences, praise the Lord, even through the pandemic, have been, blessed in receiving tithe. God's people, and this is really where it boils down to, the faithfulness of God's people is absolutely astounding. And maybe speak a little bit about that. We'll definitely touch again at the end, but maybe speak a little bit about that, Randy.
Yeah, let me, before I say that, Javier, just to add one little thing to what you were saying earlier.
Yeah.
I would say that the General Conference is such an important part of the World Church, because at that level, they are supporting, literally, they're supporting the mission of the World Church. I was in a meeting just yesterday talking about how we fund our missionaries around the world. And there's some restructuring going on in that space. But at the General Conference level, that's just one of several things that they do on a world basis. The funding and management and movement of mission service around the world is a critical part of what the General Conference does. And that's part of where those dollars go that we send them and other divisions send them to assist the world field. To your point about
faithfulness.
Sorry?
The faithfulness of God's people.
Sorry, yes. The faithfulness of our people. Let me tell you, when the pandemic started, the treasurers kind of got together and said, man, churches are not are not meeting now in person, that we started closing churches in about mid-March. And so we were conjecturing together financially and saying, okay, wow, if churches aren't meeting, you know, we're not going to be able to collect offerings and tithe. And literally we were coming up with numbers of tithe going down in double digits, 10, 15, and even some people were talking 20% lower. And how do you manage that? I mean, as an organization that affects the world church, I mean, tithe affects the world church. How do you deal with a 20% drop in tithe in your main funding source? And we were really struggling with that early on in late March and April. But I tell you, God is blessed and the people are faithful. They figured out how to send their tithe. They just figured mm-hmm. And there are some mechanisms in place. Adventist giving is a significant assistant to a significant mechanism where people are using to send their tithes and offerings. Online giving mechanism, and people found out how to use it. That mechanism of Adventist giving has gone up exponentially. I mean, just about half of the tithe we receive right now in the Seventh-day Adventist Church in North America comes through that mechanism. Mm. Fraction of that before the pandemic. So people figured it out. And right now through July, we are not down 20%. We are not down 15 or 10%. We're not even down 5%. Through July, we are year over year, we're down 1.32%.
Mm.
Which is astounding. This is a treasure praising God for a 1.32 loss in tithe. That doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
But compared to what it could have been and what we thought it might be, that is nothing short of divine intervention. And I just praise God for the faithfulness of his people who have really made an effort. I mean, they have said, I need to get my tithe to the church. How do I do that? Because I'm not going to church. They figured it out. And we just praise God. And we hope that we're being good stewards of those resources that our people have so vigorously figured out how to get to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And we want to use those resources in the most efficient way that we can.
Well, I appreciate that, Randy. I think it's important to, and I know that you've, again, been on several different shows, like here at the Restore Podcast, Elisa as well, that I think in times past, we didn't really see our CFOs, our treasurers of the different entities, whether that be local conference or union or division, so much out there, if I can say it that way, you know, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys have been out there, you've been talking about it. And so it shows the continued transparency that, hey, we're willing to answer any question. We understand that, you know, nothing is perfect. We're willing to assess. And really just our society as a whole, they want to hear that. They want to see that transparency and understanding that things can be better. And so let's work together of how we can go about making things better, and also hearing from different people about that. But now that they are hearing what you have to say, Elisa, and many others, of how the system works, I think that was part of the, as I listened to many people, they had some good points of, you know, of how the church could improve. But also I realized that many didn't have the information really of how our system worked. Whether they approved or not wasn't really the point. It was that they weren't fully informed of how it works, like the tithe, you know, dollar, of how much it stretches out. And so it's great to hear these things as we continue forward, trying to fulfill the mission that God has given us. So with that said, Randy, I do want to ask you before I let you go, it'll only be another hour or two of Zooming. This is a long format podcast here. So, but speaking of assessing, adjusting, adapting, where do you think, and I know you've been asked this before, that things can be adjusted when it comes to the unions and divisions and GC, in a sense, you know, financially or any other way, you know, structurally. People, nothing new. People have questioned, do we really need the union? Do we really need a division? It seems most of the work is happening at the local level, conferences. Again, I go to the conversation I had with Elder Dan Jackson, and he mentioned that he felt like, you know, conferences would have to shift. And I'm using my words, but we have all of these conferences that we would, at some point financially, it wouldn't be sustainable to have as many conferences as we have now. Basically, he talked about, and people could go back and listen to that. So what are your thoughts in regards to structural change?
Yeah, I have some different feelings maybe than some on that. And I think what Elder Jackson said is not inaccurate. I think if in a perfect world, if we could start from scratch, we probably would not have 59 conferences in the North American division. We probably would not have the number of universities we have, or, you know, structural numbers of certain things. We just wouldn't. We wouldn't build it that way. But the way our structure is constructed, it's difficult, and I don't mean this in a way that we shouldn't try. Please don't misunderstand. But it's very, very difficult to simply say, okay, we've got 50, 58, 59 conferences, depending on how you count them, today, and we really need 40. So let's make it 40. It's not that simple.
Right, right.
And the reason it's not that simple is because we're built on a constituent model. And that is to say, Seventh-day Adventist Church structure exists in its combined form only and only because we agree to do it that way. There's nothing that is compelling the organization. There's nothing compelling a Florida conference to be a part of the Seventh-day Adventist Church system. The Florida conference exists in that system because they want to be. It's really that simple. We don't, you know, the division does not oversee the unions. It doesn't. We're not structured that way. We're autonomous. We simply agree to work in a policy structure that we've all agreed to do. And that's really the only reason we exist structurally. So to say to a conference, we don't need you anymore. We only need we need less conferences. That's not, nobody has the authority to do that except that local conference's constituency. If they decide to shut down, that's their choice. Mm-hmm. It's really only their choice. Nobody else has the authority. There are some really nuanced processes that might come into play in a catastrophic situation, but essentially each individual grouping of the church is autonomous in terms of how it functions within the structure of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. So because of the constituent model, we can't easily simply say, okay, let's move from 58 conferences to 40. There's no way to do that. Each one of those would have to act on its own and say, yeah, we don't want to do business anymore, and we'll merge with the other one. And they'd all have to decide to do that independently. And that's not likely going to happen. So figure out other ways to be efficient. And so in answer to your question, Javier, in terms of, you know, what do we do structurally? You know, I think we have to all individually in our own space, my lane, is the North American Division office. What can I do as the financial officer of the North American Division to streamline and make efficient in the best way possible the dollars that I have been provided with by our donors and our givers? What can I do to make that as efficient as I can possibly make it within the structure of the church? Elisa, the money she gets from her donors, has to, as the financial officer of the Florida Conference, decide how can I make my dollars in the Florida Conference as efficient as I possibly can, and do that in a way that maximizes the resource that I've been given. Now, we do that collaboratively. I actually talk to Elisa sometimes and say, how can we better serve? How can we better work together? I talk to her union treasurer and say, David Friedman, mm-hmm. and say, David, how can the North American division work with you to maximize the efficiency of the dollars we collectively share and we send back and forth to each other? That's how I think we can achieve it. It's not going to be really to say we need less of these things or less of those organizations. It's not going to work efficiently that way. I think we just have to talk to each other. And I love the way you said it earlier, the three A's. That's mm-hmm. that's what we need to keep doing together. We have to talk together to make sure that in my lane, in Elisa's lane, in any other officer's lane and local entities, the pastor, the local treasurers, the local officers, all through the organization, we have to ask ourselves, how can we make these dollars the most efficient we can make them? And talking together and working together to stretch those dollars out. To me, that's the best way to do it. I don't know if we can mandate some organizational shift. I just don't think that's going to be effective.
Yeah. And just an extension on that, because, you know, I'll just, those three A's, the assessing, adapting, and I forgot the other A already.
Adjusting.
There you go. So in Florida, we're doing that. We're looking at our finances and how we utilize the Tide dollar and how we can stretch it further and how we can have even more of an impact at the local church level, right? Because the high impact ministry occurs at the local church level. And so we've decided that as much as possible, we're going to keep trying to put in more evangelistic dollars into the local church. And we're still reviewing that, you know, from year to year. Do you have any thoughts from your experience and from your levels as well? Do you have any thoughts in terms of how we can ensure that even more funds are allocated to the local church level where that high impact ministry occurs?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Elisa, that's just the way that's going to happen is talking to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, the Seventh-day Adventist Church has a great story. I mean, we just don't tell it well. You know, I boiled it down to how tithe touches every level of the organization. That's a great story, and there are stories in between there on that path from the local church or from the local church giver, from the donor at the local church, all the way to a local church in Zambia. There are tremendous stories of how the financial system benefits the kingdom of God on that path from the local giver in North America all the way to that local church in Zambia. We just don't tell them well, and that's one of my frustrations, Javier, yeah. for mentioning earlier. I wish we told the stories better, because they're huge, great stories, and we just don't do it well. But we have to talk, I think, Elisa, together to figure out how each other functions. I think even in the church, we don't understand how the local church needs to function and how the conference functions and union and all the services. I mean, it's easy to say, okay, well, let's get rid of the unions or let's get rid of the division or GC. We don't need them. That's an easy statement to make, but do we really understand what doing that would mean? I think there are some major unintended consequences that we don't consider because we don't understand each other. And I think to your point, Elisa, it's incumbent on me as the chief financial officer of the North American division. It's incumbent on me to recognize the needs that my local church has, talk to my pastor, find out the frustrations he has. It's incumbent on me to talk to the officers of a conference and say, you know, what are your frustrations? What can I help you do that you are struggling to do right now? It may not be quick. We may not even be able to do it, but at least let me talk and understand what that dynamic may be. And the same through all the organization. I need to understand it. And then understanding can affect some changes. And frankly, you know, I think part of that discussion, part of the parity conversation that we referenced earlier, is a byproduct of that. We are making changes. Dollars are shifting. Where organizations receive certain amounts of dollars, they have decided, we've collectively decided to say, we're not going to send dollars that way anymore. We're going to send them over here instead. And there's a large push appropriately to assist the local church more, because that's where the rubber meets the road often. It's not exclusive. I will say, you know, I've worked at every level of the church, and ministry and mission happens at every level of the church. Mm-hmm. Church all the way to the general conference office. Ministry and mission is happening. But a lot of it happens at the local church, and we need to recognize that, and we need to direct our resources to ways and means to assist that local church in reaching its community with the gospel for Jesus.
Mm. Thank you, Randy, for that. I just one quick follow-up, just for fun, before I ask you just a couple more questions, and then we'll definitely let you go. And again, thank you for your time, and Elisa as well, and thank you for co-hosting. But let's just say, hypothetically, if you can change one thing tomorrow, or today, I should say, that funds would go more to the local church, what would it be? One or two things. And we won't hold you to it, nor the many people that will listen to this. Or maybe they will. I don't know. I can't speak for them, but I can speak for myself. I won't hold you to it. Just hypothetically, what would be maybe one or two things that you would say, if I could just snap my fingers and do it, I would try to do the X.
Yeah, I see a huge need, and our political environment complicates everything, but aside from that, there's some huge, huge needs in our immigrant population. You know, the United States of America is a haven for people that are trying to get away from oppression and other challenges in life that they suffer in their home countries, and lots of reasons. And the church has been a recipient of those individuals, and they come with a desire to connect into the Seventh-day Adventist Church in a meaningful way. Mm. There is just a lack of resource. I mean, it's woefully inadequate. Mm-hmm. I wish I could take some dollars from somewhere and say, let's help this group of people connect into the Seventh-day Adventist Church in North America in a way that's meaningful. We are doing some things, and there are some dollars flowing. There's no question about that. But that's a huge need I see, Javier, just meeting the needs of those individuals in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Mm. Our education system is another one that is struggling, and it's struggling more in the context of the pandemic. I was on the phone the other day, just the other day, about with somebody and talking about the struggles of some churches in this particular geographic area, and the census of students is the enrollment is going down by scores of students because they can't show up. The legal environment is preventing that, and the online thing may not be working quite as well as they hoped it would. And so what do we do? What do we do to keep our kids educated in our school system? What I hear politically out there in the public arena in terms of relating to religion is, in my opinion, lacking. And I commend the kids that are out there in the public universities and the public schools who are sharing their faith. But we need to also maintain our educational system where religion and a relationship with Jesus in the context of Seventh-day Adventism is important into everything we teach. We need to maintain that somehow. And it's really getting difficult now in the pandemic. And so those are things that I just wish I could just grab dollars from somewhere, put it over there and make that work. Obviously that doesn't work because where you grab dollars from is also a need, and whatever that may be. And so it's a difficult conversation, but those are two areas that my heart just hurts because we don't have the resources.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that, Randy. And again, just listening to you and knowing a little bit about you, obviously, and Elisa as well. And I've said this, you know, to her before, we all have here in, you know, Florida. And of course I'm being biased here, but it's great to hear your hearts for mission, you know, and I know that exists in all over the NAD, is that our treasurers, our CFOs are really missionaries within their lane, as you said, as you used the word. And it's great as you get to really, I encourage to, you know, people to talk to the CFOs and, you know, listen to their heart for mission. And so when I hear that, you know, it encourages me, you know, as well to say, praise God that we have people in those positions that ultimately their desire is the desire for the mission of God to move forward. And that's quintessentially in my book important. One of my last questions for you, Randy, is, and then Elisa, if you have any final thoughts as well, or any final questions, 2020 has been a crazy year. I mean, I can use a lot of other words, but what are some of the top leadership lessons that you've learned overall? I mean, it doesn't have to pertain to finances, of course, but just as a leader in the North American division, as a leader in your home, as a leader in your local church, what are some of the lessons that you've learned that those who will be listening to this podcast, many of them leaders themselves in those same realms and beyond, can learn from you?
Yeah, I think as you said, Javier, 2020 has taught us a lot of things. I guess for me personally, my tendency, my tendency is to lean on my experience. And granted, yes, as a 60-year-old man, I have professional experience in the Seventh-day Adventist Church of, you know, approaching 38 years in the financial area. So I've seen a lot in the church. I've seen it, and my tendency is to lean on that. And a lesson I've learned, particularly in this pandemic, is that's not a safe thing to lean on. Does it help? Is it a tool that I have? Of course it is. It certainly helps that I've done and seen so much in the financial space of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and how it works. But to use that as a major prop up is not going to work, particularly as I see our church's eschatology play out. There's so much that is unprecedented that we're dealing with. My experience in, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago may be a small assistant in how we deal with any given situation, but I have got to be willing to listen to other people, to respond to the present unprecedented situations that are presenting themselves. The church has never dealt with the things that we're dealing with today, and that is going to require a leader to be flexible, to listen, to reassess, to step back from tradition, and look at the situation through eyes that are relevant to what's going on in front of me, instead of simply relying on my reaction that would be natural because of my experience. And just to kind of stay in that rut, it's not going to be functional anymore. I have to be much more flexible as a leader and open my heart to being different, to consider different perspectives. That's probably the biggest lesson I've learned. You know, it's very easy, and this is my nature is to just rely on what I know. I don't think I'm alone in that. I think
no.
But as a leader, I have got to get out of that. Not to ignore it, because it's an important tool, but to be much more flexible and open to what others are saying and seeing and experiencing, yeah. to consider new methodologies. And, you know, I can't say we can't do that. I can't say that anymore. We can't do it that way because we've never been able to do it that way.
Yeah.
That's a mm-hmm. unfortunate conclusion if I'm positioning myself that way, because we can. And the other thing is, as we all do, growing in our relationship with Christ, this is God's church. This is not my church.
Mm. Yeah. Amen.
No, it's God's church. And mm-hmm. I admit this, I lay up and worry about stuff. I don't need to do that because God has it.
Amen. And flexibility is key. That's important. Thank you for sharing that. God's got it. Yeah. It's His church, and He will continue to control how things are going. You know, you've been serving, you said 38 years, just an amazing legacy that you're leaving. And as we wind down, you know, the question comes in my mind, what can you share? What can you say to listeners that are either young, still in college, wondering whether working for church, working for the Lord in some other capacity other than pastoral ministry, whether it's at administration, whether it's finances, whether it's human resources, or maybe some professionals that are feeling that there's a time for a change in their career, because we continue to have the need for dedicated Christians to serve God's church and watch Him lead through them as we move forward. Any last words on that to encourage people to consider serving God and His church professionally?
Yeah, we have several, I'll even say many of those kinds of individuals at the North American division. And I know around the division territory, those people, yourself included, Elisa, and Javier, I mean, just younger individuals who have decided to make a career in the church. I love that. And I've got a... I would encourage them to be patient with us. You know, I've said that my disposition is to lean on my own experience and my own journey. That means that people that are coming up, that are younger and have new ideas, are going to have to be patient with me getting out of my rut. It's going to take me a second to do that. I don't look at life the way my kids do. You know, they look at life completely differently, and they see different possibilities and different processes. I've got to figure out how to embrace that, even though it's not what I conclude. So I guess my message would be, please be patient with the church. There is a place for you and your voice in the church. The other thing is, you know, I think there's an expectation sometimes of my kids' generation, the 30 somethings, that, you know, I've gone to school, I've had certain life experience, I've had this kind of exposure, and therefore I should be able to, you know, I can move into really significant roles quickly. And if you can, that's awesome. But I think it's going to be better if you're patient with yourself. You know, start where you start, do what you can do where you are, be patient with yourself and be patient with the church, because the church will allow you. I'm an example of that. I started as a business intern, a 20-something kid that thought I knew everything, but didn't know anything. And it just took time for me to integrate my thoughts into the structure. There is a place for that. And I say to those individuals, be patient. Keep talking. Keep sharing perspective. We'll get it. We will. It'll take us a moment, but we will get it. And And so please be persistent and patient.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Yes, thank you so much, Randy, for your time. Thank you for your explanations and getting into the weeds a bit. And I know that we can go on, and I really also, people maybe noticed it as you were speaking there, as you were answering some of these last questions. But we that are obviously seeing you, we can see how you were tearing up just as knowing that this is God's church, that God's in control. And you're not alone. Elisa could speak for herself, but hey, in my little world here, I've been anxious. I've gone to bed at times, you know, wondering things for the church, for pastors, for my own life. And at the end of the day, I think I've come to that same, that same conclusion in principle, meaning God is in control. At the end of the day, if he's not, I don't know what to say.
Yeah, we're in trouble.
We're in trouble. Some people in some spaces don't want to say that or whatever. That's their, you know, choice. I'd said I've spoken to pastors, and at times I've just said, you know, I don't know. I you know, 2020, I don't know. I don't know how to answer you at this point. So we appreciate that, you know, vulnerability, you know, and everything that you've added and helped over your years and your ministry here. So thank you, Randy, for your time. Elisa, of course, as always, thank you for being part of this episode and, you know, co-hosting it. So blessings to both of you.
Thank you so much,
Javier. It's been a privilege.
Well, there you have it, friends. I hope this conversation was helpful and hopeful. Thank you so much for listening. And I want to thank also in a very special way, of course, Randy and Elisa for their time. If you haven't already, please subscribe and share the Restore Podcast if the Spirit impresses you. Until next time, God bless.
Thank you for listening to this Restore Podcast. We hope you've been blessed. Don't forget to subscribe so you won't miss any of our inspiring episodes.